alguns. E não são gente.
Quero ir no meu tronco, gente.
Hi, everybody. My name is Tim Cohen.
And I'm Fred De Vries.
And this is the perfect song for. We are two journalists. I'm actually more a kind of political journalist, and I write about economics a bit. Fred, what do you do?
I'm basically, I guess, a foreign correspondent because I live in South Africa and I write for Dutch publications. But that said, I write quite a few music stories. And I have a music column for a local online magazine called Vrije Weekblad every second week. And I guess what we should also add is that we're both music fanatics.
Yes, you're not only a music fanatic, you've actually written books about music, just whole books, you know, with a whole bookishness about them, which are published and by publishers. It's very impressive.
That is true, Tim. I'm a writer more than a journalist these days, I think.
Okay. Yes, and I write occasionally about music too, and of course I like music a lot. So what we are doing is we have decided to do a podcast called The Perfect Song For, and we've come up with a whole bunch of crazy ideas about choosing songs. It's really just an excuse to talk about songs, right?
Yeah, and we had a few trials. We wanted to do it actually on TV.
But then we decided that nobody wants to look at us.
Yes, maybe they want to hear us, but they don't want to look at us. So this is the first episode, right? And it's the perfect song for making a podcast about the perfect song for.
Okay.
So here we go, Tim.
Here we go. And we each choose three songs. And we play them, and then at the end, we'll choose the perfect song for the occasion, whatever it is. And obviously, what we're interested in is what you think your perfect song is for a podcast about the perfect song, and whether we've made the right choice. But in the meantime, maybe I can just ask you, Fred, what you have been listening to.
Well, I had to do some big drives because I was doing a story about black wine farms. And there are very few black wine farms actually in the Western Cape or in South Africa in general. And there was one that I found in Botrivier, which is about maybe 2 hour drive from where I stay. And there was another one that was in Franschhoek, which is about 1.5 hour, 145 minutes drive from where I stay. So I had plenty of time to listen to the radio, and when that got very boring, I started playing music. And I brought with me a number of CDs. I still have a CD player in my car. David Bowie, because I've been going through a Bowie phase, and I'm planning to write a piece about why Bowie was or is more influential than Bob Dylan.
Oh my God. That is crazy.
I know you're Dylan.
Well, good luck with that. All right. So we're going to play little snippets of songs, just very short. Here's the Bowie song that actually I chose for you. Here we go.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom. 7, 6, commencing countdown.
I mean, compare that to Mr. Tambourine Man. Then it's pretty obvious who's better.
Yeah, I mean, that was an interesting song. I mean, I was reading a little bit about David Bowie. It's incredible to think now, but he was known for quite a long time as a one-hit wonder. And that was the one hit.
Yeah.
He was known as the Space Oddity guy. Mm-hmm. And he, for years in the early 70s, it looked as though he was actually going to be a kind of songwriter by profession. Not a performing artist until he found rock. I think until he found a way to sound more serious, or maybe took himself more seriously. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I mean, I read up, of course, about him as well. And he was a pantomime player, and he tried all sorts of different musical genres, let's call it. I mean, he was a mod for a while, and then he tried sort of more folky ballads, and he tried music hall, like, you know, real British music, and none of it really worked. Although he made some really good albums before he became, let's say, before The Man Who Sold the World. But with The Man Who Sold the World, that was, I think, became his breakthrough as a rock star. And I think it's also the first album that had The Spiders from Mars. I mean, Mick Ronson on guitar. And he had a sort of hard rock sound on that album. And then, of course, after that, we got Hunky Dory, which really put him there as a great singer and songwriter.
Yes. But, you know, he never lost that kind of experimentalism. I mean, it's interesting, even on this song, you know, there was this, you know, he was telling these stories. It's very interested in science fiction, quite experimental musically. And that's he sort of carried through right through his career. It was absolutely amazing.
To his old songs as well, in later songs, which I also find interesting. You know, he refers to Major Tom in, I forgot which song it was, much later. And his second last album, with the cover that looks like Heroes, but then with a white square in the middle, is all about his time in Berlin revisited and looking back on it. But I was playing his later albums, some of his later albums, which I didn't really know very well. And they were actually really, really good. And I realized that all along, he remained a pop singer. I mean, he wrote pop songs. And Dylan, of course, didn't so do that. Dylan wasn't a pop singer. I think he abhors the idea of pop songs, actually. But he does write pop songs as well. But we're not going to go into the Dylan versus Bowie. We'll leave that for another time.
Okay. All right. Well, you'll be amazed at what I've been listening to recently. I'm more and more interested in cover versions. And I've got a whole bunch today. So this is my first one. Let's take a look.
Let's dance to a song that's playing on the radio.
Another Bowie reference.
Yes. I mean, the original version, of course, was extremely upbeat, high tempo, you know, designed to get you to, in fact, dance. And this is by M. Ward, and he's kind of slowed it down a lot. He's made it more kind of soulful. And, you know, when he does that, you realize how clever the song is. It's just how lyrically and musically unusual it sounds. It's just, I don't know, it's a great version, I think.
It is.
Anyway, let's get into it. Okay, so now, the perfect song for a podcast about the perfect song. How do you even approach that? What goes through your mind?
It was more sort of intuitive idea. And then I thought, well, what does it mean, the perfect song for? Is it the perfect song? So I started looking at what makes a song perfect, what makes it have all the ingredients and still manages to touch your heartstrings, you know, because there's plenty of songs, especially these days, I think, which sort of are made as perfect songs for the hit parade because of very clever writers. And, you know, there's been like, 50 plus years of pop song craft that we can draw back on. So I thought I've chosen three songs that are very different from each other. And to me, they all epitomize a perfect pop song, right?
Okay. Right.
And for me, I mean, and two of them were huge hits. One was a sort of hit in the alternative world, but they're also different kinds of music. So we don't, I didn't want to restrict myself to just, you know, the usual, because I'm a huge lover of the Kinks. And I was struggling with which Kinks song shall I use. And then I decided to not use a Kinks song. Much to my chagrin.
Your own surprise.
Well, I thought the Kinks must be there, but the song I've chosen that could have been a Kinks song is actually, for me, epitomizes the perfect pop song from the 60s.
Okay. Right. Well, if it wasn't the Kinks, it was the Beatles. Here's your first song.
I need somebody, help. Not just anybody, help. You know I need someone, help. When I was younger, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help.
All right, tell us about this. Why is that the perfect pop song?
It has everything that a pop song should have. It has a perfect intro. You know, it doesn't beat around the bush. It comes straight in with like this heartfelt shout of help, I need somebody. Then right. it has these harmonies that are ahead of what John Lennon, in this case, is going to sing, which is quite unusual. You know, when I was young, then... But they are slightly ahead of him. And I love harmonies. I love, and on Help, they are perfect. Then instead of a middle eight, which you'd expect, they play the first verse again, but in a much softer, slightly, I guess, slower version. And then they pick up again. And the end is also perfect for me. Like it doesn't fade out or they don't know what to do anymore. It ends and it's finished. And it's beautiful, perfect ending. Shall I read you a bit about the background to Help?
Sure. Okay.
This is from a book by Ian MacDonald, and it's called Revolution in the Head, The Beatles Records and the 60s. And in it, he analyzes all the songs. He was a huge Beatles connoisseur. He's dead. He says, Help retains its authenticity through the emotion in its author's voice. Looking back on this song in 1980, Lennon recalled it as a cry for help from the depths of what he referred to as his Fat Elvis period. Mentally exhausted by 2 years of continuous touring, he was isolated and alienated in his multi-roomed mansion in the stockbroker belt of London's Western Fringe. His marriage damaged by his orgiastic rounds of whores and groupies on the road, he felt unsustained by his faithful and attentive wife, Cynthia, who, concerned for her husband's health, made no secret of disapproving of his drug intake. All of this amounted to a personal malaise that would expand to overwhelming dimensions during the next 2 years. Now he talks about the lyrics. He says, here the shell he had grown around his feelings since his mother's death finally cracks as he admits a need for others. And then he talks about the song starting in an unhappy B minor after the intro. I think they were recorded on 4-track, probably recording machines. And this is an incredibly complicated, complex song that sounds very simple. And yeah. I forgot how long it lasts, but it's about 3 minutes, I would say. Not even.
Yeah, no, it's even less.
2 minutes something. I mean, so... To me, this is a perfect pop song.
No, it's just amazing. I mean, I love the it's got a real bounce to it, and there's a sort of contrast. It's quite a happy melody, you know, in a strange kind of way.
Even though the B minor.
I don't know, B minor. The
they wanted to record it slower. They wanted it more mid tempo, but they increased the speed to make it more snappy and more aimed at the pop market. Well, it was number one in all over the world, so yeah, they did succeed there. But it's also interesting, I think it's for the first time in pop music that somebody opens up like that. You know, usually that song's about girls and this and that, but now it's a cry for help. It is. I mean,
there is.
And it's quite something in those days. We're talking 1965.
Ago. And the Beatles did that, you know, right through their careers. They seem so contemporary. You know, they seem to have held their space. And it's partly because they were, you know, the ultimate pop band and yet more. You know, there was always something more. You know, there was always something, an additional aspect to the song structure or the content that just lifted them above everybody else. This is amazing. All right. Well, let's move on.
Can beat that, Tim.
My kind of story about the perfect is that a long time ago, you know, there's this radio series called Desert Island Discs, And we went to a lunch party and somebody, just as a joke, said, all right, let's all bring three tracks that we would take as our songs that you would take to a desert island, right? So if, in case you don't know, it's a radio program. They have famous people.
Yeah,
they
BBC.
Play eight. Yeah, yeah. They play sort of eight songs. And these are the songs that you would theoretically take with you. But you know, there's a big difference between eight and three. It's three songs is very difficult. So, you know, we spent days trying to work out what three songs. And, you know, I think this is my the start of my interest in cover versions, because I thought, well, let me get songs that are, you know, played by people different from the person who wrote them, because then you get both, right? It's sort of like a double whammy. Anyway, so you'll recognize the song, of course.
Must be some kind of way out of here, said a joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief.
So this is, of course, Jimi Hendrix's version of All Along the Watchtower, which, by the way, was his highest charting single. And it was a cover version, obviously, of Bob Dylan's song. And, you know, it's strange enough, as we sort of play them, it has quite a lot of... there's quite a lot of comparisons with Help, because there's also a sort of confusion and desperation in the storyline, but it's much more esoteric, as Dylan always is. Hendrix actually brings an enormous amount to the song. You know, it's that sort of like, wow, 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 wow. In the beginning, he smashes you straight into the song, and it rolls along a very determined kind of way. It was just a sort of masterclass, I think, in what you could do with these new instruments, which was really, you know, what Hendrix was doing. He was sort of taking popular music into spaces that had never been before. So anyway, I just thought it's in its own way, it's perfect. What did you think?
It's also quite amazing that this ends up in the top 40 or top whatever. Because, I mean, originally it wasn't a very commercial song, and Hendrix doesn't make it very commercial with those loud guitar solos. And, you know, I'm always surprised when people say apparently he didn't like his own singing much, because I think he's a brilliant singer. I love his voice. I think he's got a beautiful voice.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Certainly on this track. And, you know, when it came out, when, 1968 or something, or 7?
Yeah.
Because I remember hearing it as a young teenager. And I didn't know the Dylan version then. I love the Hendrix version. Then later you hear that it's cover of this other guy called Bob Dylan, who
right.
I really only knew from Mr. Tambourine Man. And then I listened to the Dylan version. I thought, yes, he really made something out of nothing there, because the Dylan version isn't very catchy. Or, you know, he really gave it color, gave it life. He gave it everything. He made it blossom.
Yes, no, he did. Yeah, yeah. All righty. Well, now, why this song is on your list, I have no idea. You can have to explain. Let's listen. All right, explain yourself, Fred.
This is Damage Goods by the Gang of Four. It came out in 1978, and it's always been seen as a sort of pinnacle of post-punk. The Gang of Four were a band from Leeds, very politicized. Leeds University, apparently, was at the time a very sort of radical left-wing institution. And you had the Gang of Four, I think the Au Pairs, the Mekons, they all came from that same politically charged environment. And I remember reading a review of this. It came out as a single. It was slower on the single. This is the LP version, I think. And I read something about funk, and I thought, I mean, I wasn't into funk at all. We were talking 1978. And then I went to the record store down the road from where I live, a tiny record store that had the latest British imports. And he had that single, Damaged Goods. And he played it. And I thought, this is brilliant. When I hear it, my heart jumps because it's done away with the idea of rock and roll. This is not a rock and roll song. It doesn't have the blues chords. It is funky in the way that that guitar goes sort of against the grain and is all over the place almost. And the bass and the drums hold the rhythm very, very well. And it's also what Talking Heads would do later. This is the precursor to that. It's very danceable, I think. And the lyrics are very interesting as well in that they sort of condemn the 60s idea of sleeping with someone for just the sake of sleeping with someone. You know, it asks questions about relationships. And it does it in a very playful way. And we didn't hear that bit, but it also has lovely background harmonies. And I, you know, I'm a sucker for that. So to me, it's a perfect single, and it sort of speeds up towards the end. It becomes quite chaotic, and then it's gang, finished. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing for a punk band how tight they were. I mean, it's an extremely exacting, from a tempo point of view, there's a real kind of zing to it, which strange enough, I think that Au Pairs also had that sort of rhythmic snap, you know, very, very powerful thing in a pop song and difficult to get right. You really have to be in sync with everybody else.
I also loved the sound of the guitar, you know, that sharp and really cut, very short little outbursts. It wasn't that the Ramones, that fuzz tone. I tried, when I was in the band, I tried to get that sound right. I had an overdrive and I put all the tones, you know, the up to right up very to sharp, yeah, so you get the tick, tick, tick. But I wasn't so good at falling back into the rhythm because what he's sort of syncopated play, but he sticks to the rhythm. And that's very hard. You know, you sort of got to play these things in between, but then fall back when the bass and the drum hit as well. So it's an incredible piece of music, I think. Did you like it?
No.
That's fine.
All right. But strange enough, my next song is not completely dissimilar. Let's try. Okay, well, clearly that was Papa was the Rolling Stone, which was a Temptation song. This was the Was Not Was version. You know, this is once again a sort of cover. The Temptations version, I like these songs which are breakthroughs. That's what defines perfection for me. For a song to be perfect, it has to be, it not only has to be engaging and, you know, and stand on its own merits, but it also has to take you further. And Papa was a Rolling Stones, you know, came out of Motown, of course, which was, you know, famous for these very disciplined love songs. You know, it was Motown was about, you know, you and your girl, you know, and what your girl did, and the girls sang about the boys, and the boys sang about the girls. You know, there was a rule to it. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, comes this, you know, very heartfelt conversation between a mother and a child. And a rather sort of sad but loving, and the poetry of it is just gorgeous. I mean, the line that was in that I played now as part of the chorus, of course, about Papa was a Rolling Stone, wherever he laid his hat was his home. You know, it was a lovely little couplet. And I do think when you're talking about perfect songs, it would just be a criminal offense not to include Motown's contribution. Anyway, that's it.
Motown also had that really dancey beat always. The Supremes and all those had that sort of da-da-da-da. And this doesn't have that at all. It was something completely new. Isn't there a sort of spoken section in it as well, in the middle somewhere?
Yes, in this version, there was a very interesting rap you know, just to follow the theme, but was more angry and was a son castigating his absent father. Which is very unusual. It's and I thought that in a way took the song even further out of its, you know, out of the comfort zone of happy.
Because the original came out when early 70s, right?
Yes, yeah.
And this one came out in the 80s?
Early 90s. That was, you know, they were sort of a mild hit-making band. They didn't make an enormous waves.
But wasn't it built around Don Was, the producer, right?
Yes, that's right. There was two brothers, and they were both Was. And their studio names. Anyway, I think they were a very good band, underestimated, it's nice to have them on.
Good choice.
All right.
Sitting on a dock or a bay, wasting time. Look like nothing's gonna change. Everything still remains the same. I can't do what 10 people tell me to do. So I guess I'll remain the same.
Oh my God.
That was my third choice. It's Otis Redding, of course, with Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. And it's a song that came out in 1967. I think it was released after he died in a plane crash. A very sad story. I think it's one of the last songs he actually recorded before he died. And according to him, it wasn't finished yet. And from what I understand is that they added the whistling at the end later. And I'm not a huge fan of whistling normally, but it certainly works on this song, I think. But for me, it's a perfect song in the sense that it came out on the Stax label. You know, there was in the 60s, you had Motown and you had Stax. Motown was Detroit, Stax was Memphis. And right. For one of my books, I went to the Stax Museum, where they have all sort of footage of Otis Redding and then Isaac Hayes and all these guys. It's a great museum. It's right in the middle. It's where the Stax studio used to be. And then it sort of fell apart a bit, and people bought it and turned it into a museum. And I love the way he sings it. He apparently had just had an operation on his throat, and he doesn't so have to stretch his voice into, you know, he does "I've Been Loving You Too Long" and all those songs where he really belts it out. But this, he can remain sort of like quite steady. And as you know, as a teenager, I used to love this because it sort of reminded me of Carefree Holidays, which apparently it's not about. You know, sitting at the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. You know, you sort of, time goes and comes, and you got no troubles. You have carefree. But later on, you know, he says, "I left my home in Georgia, heading for the Frisco Bay," which happened to a lot of black people after the end of slavery, is that they had to find ways to make a living. So you had the big migration from the South to the West and to the North. And this is a song that sort of recalls that, I guess. And also it talks about disillusion, because he goes there, he sits there in that San Francisco, and he still hasn't got a job. So it's actually a very sad song. And apparently the people that he recorded it with weren't convinced that it was going to be a hit single. And one of them managed to tell him that he should swap the first verse for the third verse and the other way around. But Steve Cropper, who played guitar on it, I'm quoting from a book now called Otis Redding, Try a Little Tenderness by Jeff Brown. And he quotes Steve Cropper, the guitarist, and says, "In my own mind, it was the best thing we ever did with him. Otis and I knew we had something when we wrote it. But when we recorded it, we said, this is it. This is the song we've been looking for. This is the one that's going to cross us over. The way he sang it was just awesome. When you do it for a living like we do, there are times when you think you've got something, and there are other times when you know you've got something. The only thing we didn't do was add the staple singers, because they wanted the background voices. Didn't work out." So I agree. I think it's a perfect song. Also, it's it was a huge crossover song. It got him, he was big among the black crowd. It got him a white crowd also after he performed at the Monterey Festival in 1967 together with Hendrix. And it was the first time that black and white music really came together. And for me, this is the song that signifies all that.
Yeah, I don't know whether it changes the way you hear it now when you know that it was released after he died. You know, it makes it even sadder that he shouldn't have seen the impact that the song has had. But anyway, I will grant you your preference. And my last song is sort of heavily influenced by the fact that this podcast is about the perfect song. I looked at songs that had perfect in the title. And of course, our intro song has perfect in the title, but I didn't want to just exclude that. And I think my favorite song ever with the word perfect in the title is this one.
Oh, it's such a perfect day. I'm glad I spent it with you. Oh, such a perfect day. You just keep me hanging on. You just keep me hanging on.
Yeah, so that's Lou Reed, of course, in The Perfect Day. I like it for a lot of reasons. Just the idea of writing a song about just what you did on a nice day. You know, it's sort of, it's so wonderfully casual and satisfied in a sort of deep kind of spiritual way. Write about something felt casually. You know, I think it's very unusual. And just walking around the park and going to a movie and then coming back. And then that is what inspires you to write a song. I mean, it's just great, don't you think?
And then you add a few lines that puts it all down again by "you're going to reap just what you sow," which sort of, that's such, yeah. I always found that such a strange addition, because you can, I mean, that I now notice that we've chosen songs, maybe not Papa Was a Rolling Stone, but the other songs all have a very universal thing about them.
Right.
And "Help Does," "Sitting on the Dove of the Bay" does, "Perfect Day" as a teenager, because this song came out in the mid-70s. There's another Bowie connection as well, because he produced that album. Is that I love that idea of Sangria in the park and later a movie too, and then home. I mean, he doesn't write about the great sex they had when they got home. He sort of implies it in a way, I guess. Yeah. And I love that, as you do as well, the subtleness of loving a day in the life without anything major happening, but it was just perfect. You know, you walk through Central Park, you have an ice cream, etc. It's, and I can so feel that. So I do agree with you that it is, and it's universal, that feeling, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, Bowie actually played on the single, and I've always wondered, you know, what the relationship was between Lou Reed and Bowie. I mean, it doesn't seem as though they were sort of on the same musical tracks. Bowie was often on a different kind of wavelength, but they were obviously good friends, and, you know, they kept up their friendship for a long time. So
there's also photos of them kissing, eh?
Okay. And I mean, yeah. I mean, I presume they were, you know, sort of were kind of flirty at some point, at least. And they also, you know, their drug of choice was heroin, which somehow they managed to survive, which I think is incredible. But anyway.
And then around the same time, they also threw Iggy in the mix.
Yes, exactly.
Because he didn't just save Lou Reed's career, but he also saved Iggy's career. I mean, he gave them both a new starting point to launch a career in pop music, because they were both, like, you know, not in a very good state, let's put it that way. So no, it's amazing what he did, and he did it out of love for those people.
He did it repeatedly. I mean, he was writing hits for other people when he wasn't getting hits himself. You know, it was rather amazing.
Yeah, he did "Onto Hoople" as well, of course. With
yes, that's right.
All the young dudes.
Yeah. Okay, so now the time has come to choose the perfect song for the perfect podcast. Okay, now this is going to be difficult. I haven't decided. I don't know which to choose.
Well, I've been thinking about it, and I mean, I can't even decide my own three songs. So let alone six songs. And I thought, because it's the first podcast and we have to plant our foot, you know, we have to show who we are. Why don't we choose all six songs as a starting point for what's to come?
Okay, that's a good idea. I'm very happy to go with the ultimate compromise solution.
Because I wouldn't know which one to throw out.
No, me neither. I think these are all great songs. I love them all.
I mean, these are 3 10 out of tens.
Yes,
I think you would throw the Gang of Four out.
Except for Gang of Four. Yeah, but I tip my hat to your love of punk. I'll try and in future find the perfect punk song. Maybe that can be one of our future topics.
For annoying your parents.
All right. Okay, well, Tim. Because we obviously need it, let's go out with possibly the best selling of all of our choices and an indication of what we need.
So, Tim, before we end on a high note with help, what are we going to talk about next week?
Yeah, so we've decided we alternate choosing what we should talk about. But I think in your honor, in fact, I think let's talk about the perfect song to play after you come out of hospital. And the reason I'm saying that is because, of course, you have just come out of hospital a few weeks ago. So you'll have lots of knowledge and experience on that topic.
That sounds like a great idea.
Okay, Doug. Till next week.
Okay.
Cheers.
We'll see you then. Bye.
I need somebody help, not just anybody help. You know I need someone help. When I was younger, so much younger than